You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A number of revelations, including the scope of the NSA's surveillance programs, have been giving big data something of a bad name, but the mountains of information being collected about people and new analytical techniques are also allowing scientists to do research that would have been impossible in the past. Using big data, Professor Alex Pentland directs research into social networks and the flow of ideas at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's written a new book that's published by Penguin Press, called Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Pentland to our show today. Hello.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Is social physics an attempt to explain social phenomena in terms of physics, or is your title more metaphorical about the way social particles, people, interact?
Well, it's a little bit of both. It's an attempt to say that what you get when you combine big data with social science is you get something that's more predictive and mathematical the way physics is. But it's also a nod to history, because the roots of sociology were first called social physics, and it was about emergence of ideas as a way of guiding society.
And there are a number of things. 140 years ago, the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell described physicists adopting the statistical methods then used in the census. Has the direction reversed now with social scientists adopting methods of physics?
That's right, yeah. So as you get more data about people, what you find is some of these statistical methods are really good for describing behavior in a very quantitative way, so that you can say, for instance, what happens in a market. It's not just economics. It's also the sociology of people interacting.
Well, over 60 years ago, the astrophysicist John Stewart and other natural scientists were writing about social physics and applying the natural sciences to the social sciences. Has it taken all this time for it to become a reality because we now have access to big data?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So people have used the phrase before, and what they meant usually are these sort of average statistics of the entire population. But it wasn't until we had, for instance, cell phones, so you know exactly where everybody goes, assuming that you've done all the human subjects and you've signed people up and paid them and whatnot, that you get such rich data that you can say exactly what is happening.
Well, is this anything like the metadata that's being collected by the NSA?
It is fairly closely related to that. So this is doing science with that data to better understand ourselves. And for myself, having done the science, that raises the alarm bells. And so I now have a parallel track, which is working on privacy architectures and how government should be changed in light of this new source of data.
And privacy was the next question I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. So
how do we protect ourselves? You just mentioned cell phones. Well, anyone can know where I am right now unless I left my cell phone at home.
Yeah, which is both good and bad. If you're in an emergency situation, E911 will come and rescue you now. Before, you would have just died by yourself someplace. On the other hand, we have the NSA. For the last 5 years, I've run a group at Davos with the World Economic Forum that tries to have a dialogue between chief regulators, companies, and advocacy groups. And I think that there's actually a good way to think about these things. It's a win-win-win solution.
What's happening in conventional approaches in psychology or sociology now that we have these new technologies?
Well, there's a wave of excitement. The more accessible things are things like Twitter and Facebook. It's sort of easier to understand. But it's actually behavior, not people's opinions, that's causing the most fundamental change.
One of the tools you use is called a sociometric badge. What are sociometric badges?
So we were interested in what goes on in companies, and cell phones typically don't work inside buildings and people don't carry them around. So I and my students built these little name badges that are just like name badges, except they know where they are, and they know about your body language and your tone of voice, and they know if you're having conversations. They don't listen to any of the words. But what you're doing is looking at the pattern of communication within a corporation. And the amazing thing we found is without listening to any of the words, we could tell which groups were being productive, which ones were being creative, which organizations had black holes that were, tripping them up.
Do the people who are wearing these badges know that they're being used in that way?
Yeah. So in everything, we're a university. We're under federal human subjects law. That means we have to be certified by the feds. We have to get our experimental plan approved by the federal government. We have to give people informed consent documents. We have to pay them. We have to give them the right to opt out whenever they want and have a very high level security. It's just like medical research.
Although it all depends on who you go to in the government. If you go to James Clapper, he says, oh, yeah, you can look at anything.
No, there's a big bureaucracy which is grinds exceedingly fine.
You also write of living laboratories. What do you mean by that?
So living laboratories are rather different. I'm of the opinion that we need to have more innovation in our society. And what that means is that you need to try things, and particularly when it comes to big data. We don't really understand either the rewards or the risks. And what we see is that there are sometimes small communities who have an opinion about how we ought to do this. And I think that they ought to be given the chance to try that. And then other people should learn from that.
Is that sort of like what Margaret Mead was doing when she was doing anthropological work?
I suppose a little bit. I mean, but let me describe one. So I worked with the European Institute of Technology and the telcos in Italy to get a little town, Trento, to have a very different set of regulations about cell phone data. Who controlled it? Well, what we did is we set it up so that the individuals, the citizens, controlled the data, not the company. And the idea there, I say, is, well, first of all, is this plausible and safe? And second of all, there's a bigger issue, which is not just privacy. It's, do you get enough sharing of information? Do you have a innovative society, or are you constructing something that's, you know, everything's locked down and people don't share anything?
My guest is Alex Pentland, who directs MIT's Human Dynamics Laboratory and the MIT Media Lab Entrepreneurship Program and co-leads the World Economic Forum Big Data and Personal Data Initiatives. He's written a book called Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science. How has your understanding of the ways that people work together in groups changed over the years as a result of your research?
Well, the way that we typically think of these things is you have all these relatively faceless people in their QBs and they're rewarded by economic incentives or penalties or something. And what we showed by looking at many different organizations is that that's a very poor model of humans.
So Dilbert is not right?
Dilbert is exactly right, is that the little QB and incentive model is completely lame. What we find, for instance, is that the side-to-side conversations, the things that you're not supposed to do, are often the biggest source of productivity. Like we went into a call center, and what we found is the people that were sort of the most chatty with each other, not with customers, but with each other, were the most productive, which is exactly what we had thought.
But that's what the bosses hate.
The bosses hate it. But fortunately, I had a little leverage over them, and I convinced them to set up coffee breaks where everybody got a break together. And lo and behold, productivity went up dramatically. People were happier because what they were doing is they were trading information about, you know, what do you do when the customer's mad? What do you do when the boss is being unreasonable? What do you do when the babysitter doesn't show up? There's a whole set of things that go into having a healthy organization. And people learn from each other, not just from some manual.
But aren't they supposed to do that during lunch breaks? If you do it during work hours, you're distracted from the job at hand.
According to the manuals, you get an instruction about what you're supposed to do, and that's all. You're supposed to be a robot. And
then you meet over the water cooler, and you exchange these ideas.
In the call center. But no, that's right. Most places, it's the water cooler, it's the lunch break that is actually the place where people actually trade the real operational information. And bosses, just because they think about things in this sort of, you know, regimented industrial way, tend to suppress that. And what we find by looking at this data is that's exactly wrong. It's the flow of ideas between people that is the source of productivity and creativity, too.
Well, one of the first things Marissa Mayer did when she took over at Yahoo was to require employees to work on site. Many of them had been telecommuting. Was that motivated by research like yours?
Yes, exactly. So that's
and people were outraged.
Well, people got used to a sort of funny situation. I remember visiting Yahoo before that, and – It was dead. There was nobody there. There was no buzz. There was, you know, people were just putting in hours and maybe, right? And so her move, you know, put a lot of noses out of joint. But what it did do is it got people banging ideas together again. And we're beginning to see some innovation and creativity come out of that.
Well, I prefer to have my guests in studio because I can pick up their body and facial cues. And I always find the interaction goes a little more smoothly. But many people in the business are perfectly happy to do their interviews over the phone. But when I think about my preference, I also think about the Kennedy-Nixon debates and how people who saw them had a very different reaction to the people who listen to them on the radio.
That's right. What we see is that rich channels of communication, face-to-face, those sorts of things, actually give you a lot of information about what really to believe, what's important, what's not important. It's that nuanced stuff that tells you which ideas are the good ideas and which are the ones that they're just saying because they're supposed to say that.
Well, is there a difference in the way that good ideas flow as opposed to the bad ones?
Yeah, so the thing that we find when we look at all of this data is that the majority of learning happens between people. So, and in fact, it's in a very particular, the social learning. So what people's behavior change depends on is seeing other people like them trying out an idea and having what appears to be success. So if the people that you consider your peers are all beginning to play with this new iPhone thing, you'll probably try one too.
Well, isn't the flow of information or ideas usually asymmetrical? And don't people often withhold information to serve their own interests?
So this is what you just said shows the sort of basic confusion. So there's information and there's ideas. Information is the sort of stuff that comes in the newspaper and over the airwaves. There's lots of things that are novelty in our environment, but those very rarely change our behavior. We change our behavior only when we see that it's going to likely be successful. And the primary way we judge that is by watching people like us trying it out. So if a couple of folks that are like you are trying it out and it looks like they're successful, then the odds are that it'll work for you too. And you can just pick up that habit without having to go through all the pain of learning how to do it.
Are there natural living laboratories? You mentioned call centers as a great subject for your study, but we don't all work in call centers unless we live in Mumbai.
So, and not even there. So companies are an interesting place to do it because they have this sort of theory of how they work and they're instrumented. So you could say, oh, this is more productive or less productive. But that's not a really great living laboratory because it's not very natural. So the sorts of things that we've done, what I've done, is gone into small communities. Like I have a small community in Cambridge of young families, and I offered free phones and some payments to everybody in the entire community if they would participate in an experiment, and they agreed, almost everybody, for a year.
What about the businesses themselves? Are they as happy as the people who would be participating?
Well, in most of the cases we go in, we discover things that are major dysfunctions in these businesses. You know, like nobody talks to customer service, right? And they go, oh my God, I never noticed that before. And then they'll put customer service in the midst of all the other people, and suddenly the problems go away. When we do this with people, we don't give them detailed information back about people ever. What we give them is just aggregate, like does this group talk to that group? Does this group talk among themselves? And we find that those two things, the sort of engagement in the group and exploration out, account for almost half of the variation between good groups and bad groups, unproductive groups.
My guest is Alex Pentland, who directs MIT's Human Dynamics Laboratory and the MIT Media Lab Entrepreneurship Program, co-leads the World Economic Forum Big Data and Personal Data Initiatives, and is a founding member of the advisory boards for Nissan, Motorola Mobility, a troubled company, unfortunately, and a variety of other startup firms. His book, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science, is published by the Penguin Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
WNYC.
WABC received support from Swan Galleries with the auction Shadows Uplifted, The Rise of African American Fine Art, Thursday, February 13th, highlighting the development of black artists in the 19th century and early 20th century. Catalogs and bidding at swangalleries.com. The New School, hosting an information session for its online and on-campus graduate programs in Media Studies and Media Management, Thursday, February 13th at 6 p.m., on the web at newschool.edu/media-nyc.
Whether you're out of town or just out and about, you won't have to miss a minute of your favorite WNYC shows. With the WNYC mobile app, you can listen to live radio streams and podcasts anywhere, anytime, on your mobile phone. There's no need to leave WNYC behind. Download the WNYC app now at wnyc.org/mobile.
We're back with Professor Alex Pentland of MIT. His book, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science, published by the Penguin Press. I asked you if the businesses are open to this. Are you drawing interest from business community? Do they see your research as being potentially helpful for them?
Well, so I wrote a paper about this last year, which won Best Paper of the Year from Harvard Business Review and Best Paper from the academic community. And the interesting thing is that's the first time those two have ever agreed. So at least there seems to be some interest in it. And then companies actually find it really useful because they don't actually know where their most valuable resource goes. And that's the ideas of the people. And what we do is we help them understand the flow of ideas within the company. That's the key thing.
Well, we've been hearing about this for a while now, haven't we? I remember maybe 30 years ago or so where American companies were being, especially auto manufacturers, were being compared with auto manufacturers in Scandinavia and Japan, where they worked as groups, where here the auto workers generally worked on an assembly line and just did the same thing again and again. And we were being told that the other system was a lot better. On the other hand, I don't know how many Volvos are being sold in this country anymore.
Well, no. So what happened is that elements of that system were adopted in the U.S. and are universal now. But what never happened is that was never applied to offices or the C-suite. And what we're doing now is we're saying, look, these same sorts of ideas should be everywhere. People have to be in the loop. Ideas have to flow.
Managers often seek to be gatekeepers for information or ideas because they see that as giving themselves more control. Is that a mistake?
It's maybe not a mistake for them, but it's a mistake for the organization because what they're doing is they're stopping innovation.
Hitachi is selling a device called the Hitachi Business Microscope, which has infrared sensors and accelerometer, a microphone sensor, and a wireless communication device. Is that much the same sort of thing as a sociometric badge that
yeah.
you were
In
talking
fact,
about earlier?
We developed a lot of that for them at MIT. And again, the idea is not to track individual people, but to ask where the average things are happening, right? I mean, does this group talk to that group? Hitachi uses it for another thing, too, which is sort of a quantified self, but it's a quantified mental self. Are you in the groove or are you constantly distracted? Do you appear to be energetic and happy or are you dragging?
Well, American culture kind of lionizes individualism. Do you think that we need to look at workplaces or group interactions differently?
I think the key thing is that, you know, we have a culture that, as you said, lionizes the individual. But what the data that we've collected show us is that's just wrong. Like, for instance, we looked at financial traders, and the financial traders that try to go it alone work substantially worse. They make much less money than the ones that have a diverse set of social learnings. On the other hand, if you get too much of that stuff, you get in an echo chamber, and then pop goes the bubble, and that's not good either.
Have all these experiments been done with Americans? Would they pretty much hold true anywhere in the world, in Europe or China or India or South America?
Well, we've done our experiments in America, Europe, Japan. a little bit in Africa, a little bit in India, and it seems to be true everywhere.
But
there
different,
are
different
cultural
cultures,
overlays on top of it, though.
Well, some cultures stress group activities, and others stress working alone.
That's right, yeah. And in some cases, like you talked about the manager who tries to control everything. In some Asian cultures, the manager is above all of that, and then at the end is the one that says, okay, what everybody said is this. And so they don't get involved in controlling it. They get involved in being sort of the person that takes the notes. It's a different strategy.
Could experiments like yours be done with other social animals?
Oh, absolutely. I like to think of myself as the Jane Goodall of humans. I mean, she goes into the jungle and watches apes. I do the same thing with the people around me. I do it with a little more high tech because it's a little faster and more efficient.
Well, we've been mentioning bees and talking about this segment. Haven't you seen many important parallels between bees and humans?
Yeah, it's amazing how similar the habits of bees are to the habits of people. So if you look, for instance, how bees decide when to move a hive, it's this collective social decision. And what we see in our data is that it's those social interactions that make us smart. I mean, the reason that we have social species, the reason that we're social species is that you can learn from each other and do a lot better than if you do it alone.
Well, long before the internet, we had Upton Sinclair's The Jungle causing a public outroar over meatpacking. Thomas Paine's Common Sense sold over 100,000 copies in 1776 and as many as a half a million in 1 year. Has the flow of ideas changed in the past 20 years with the net and social media?
So if you have read Danny Kahneman's Fast and Slow Thinking book.
We had him on the show as a guest.
Yeah, so you know, he has a Nobel Prize. I don't. You don't. So let's trust him, Fast and Slow Thinking. There's an interesting parallel, which is books, media, those are things that go into our slow thinking that we like to play with new ideas. We get outraged and so forth. But if you look at the behavior change, it's a very different process. It's something that we learn from other examples around us. And that has not changed so much. Well, so we explore a lot more, but actually we're still pretty conservative as individuals.
Well, if books like The Jungle or Common Sense sold so well, it meant that something was at work. People had to hear about it from other people.
That's right. Yeah, so what ends up happening
is... How is that different from today? What we call word of mouth.
Yeah, well, so that's just it, is that those things sort of spike the population with this idea, and people play with it, and if they begin to really think, hey, this really is right, they infect each other.
My guess is Professor Alex Pentland of MIT. His book, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One interesting detail in your book is that kith and kin comes from the Old English and Old German for knowledge. Does that suggest that people have been aware of the implications of networks as ways of getting ideas for centuries?
Yeah, it's really interesting. When you go back and you look at these words, you find that at least in Northern Europe, people understood that you learn from your peers and that's how you get to have the proper way of acting. And in fact, actually, that's how you survive. You learn from each other. And so kuth, so the proper way of acting, kith, those are the people you learn from.
And we had apprenticeship systems all over the world.
Absolutely.
Internships, although in this country now that's a bit controversial because interns now, some people say, should be paid, even though exchange would be invaluable.
Even if you discount sort of formal interns, when somebody goes to a new job, they pick up the culture. What is that? Well, that's actually learning from the people around you, and it's that stuff which makes the organization go.
How much are the way that we do things, the way that we interact with others, a product of old ways of doing things, of convention or habit?
Well, convention and habit is another word for that is culture, and a very large percentage of what we do is that. And today we often think of that as being bad because it's old. But in fact, if people didn't have a common understanding of how to do things, the world would be chaos.
Well, Max Weber introduced the notion of methodological individualism. It's probably easier for you to say. You probably say it all the time. Social phenomena should be explained in terms of individual behaviors. Does your work depart from that view?
No, there's an individual explanation, but the thing that he missed is the following, is that you can make much better decisions, objectively better decisions, by tapping the behavior of the people around you and learning from it. You can almost always do better if you pay attention to your peers than if you do it individually. It's very rare that the stuff between your ears is better than the community around you.
Psychologists and behavioral economists have challenged some of the traditional views of rationality, especially as it's used in neoclassical economics. Are you also challenging some of the standard views in the behavioral sciences?
Yeah, so they have this idea of the rational individual, and people have beat up the notion rational for a long time. I'm beating up the notion individual. Mm-hmm. Right? We are not individuals. What we value, the ways we go about doing things, we learn from each other overwhelmingly. And what that means is that the rationality is really more a rationality of the group than of the individual.
But this can work in another way as well. I just saw a documentary about the Amish, and anyone who becomes even slightly nonconformist winds up being asked to leave.
Right.
You have to agree 100% with everything that the group agrees
on. So when we look at lots of different cultures and lots of different organizations, what we see is that there's two main things. One I call engagement, which the Amish have lots of. Everybody talks to each other. Everybody copies each other. But there's no creativity and no innovation. Cultures like
that. On purpose.
On purpose. But that's sort of the way things were in the Middle Ages, too. However, when you take those communities and you put them next to each other and you allow copying back and forth between them, you begin to get innovative organizations, innovative cities that also have social support. So, for instance, if you look at the city of Paris, it's made up of lots of little villages called arrondissements, and it's the communication between those villages that actually made Paris great. Same for Boston, same for New York.
In other words, Williamsburg talks to Greenpoint, the West Village talks to the East Village.
Yeah. And so there's was a classic debate in New York, for instance, in the 30s between Jane Jacobs and, Morse?
Robert Moses.
Moses, right. Moses wanted to put highways everywhere, and Jane Jacobs wanted to have these good whole communities. And the answer is both is right. You need the communities for social support, but you need the highways to get ideas to bang together and get innovation. In fact, here's a really interesting thing. As we looked at 150 cities in the U.S. and 150 cities in Europe, and we found that if you told me the pattern of transportation and the density of the city, I could tell you the GDP fairly precisely. So, or if you told me the GDP, I could tell you the pattern of interaction.
And what is the rule there? If the city has a ring around it, it doesn't do as well as the city that has main roads going through it?
There's lots of different topologies you can have. The key thing is there's a very simple story which turns out to be the correct one. So that is when ideas bang together from different communities, that's the source of innovation and that's the source of GDP. And things like specialization, class structure, even education are secondary factors.
Several scientific fields, neuroscience and psychology, sociology, evolutionary biology, economics, seem to be looking at problems of how we think or should behave and how we actually do. Does your work touch on that?
Yeah. So what my work does is it uses this very rich data to be able to understand who we are. And we discover that we have this social side, which is typically forgotten in the way we manage ourselves. And so one of the things that the book goes into is if you really begin taking seriously the notion that we're a social species, you would have governments that would be very different than the governments we would have today. One of the things you'd have is a lot more innovation. Instead of having one rule for all of New York, all the different boroughs, all the different parts would be willing and able to try different ways of living and copy each other.
Now, you mentioned ethical concerns, privacy. Joshua Green was here to talk about neuroscience and moral behavior. And Paul Bloom was here just last week to talk about moral psychology. There are a lot. There's a lot of study in evolutionary economics and evolutionary psychology going on these days. Are we seeing a whole bunch of different things all circling around the same basic points?
I think so. The standard story in our society really came about with John Locke and Adam Smith back at the end of the 1700s, and we're beginning to reevaluate that. What my work shows is that it's really the flow of ideas between people that is the source of innovation, creativity, productivity. And so privacy is not actually the right debate to have. The right debate to have is how do we have a community, a society that has great idea flow and yet at the same time protects the individual? You have to have both.
Well, all too often I wind up calling some organization for some information, and I just wind up being given a runaround by some robotic voices. And no matter how much I try to talk to
–
yeah. Well, but doesn't this go against everything you're saying?
Absolutely.
Are companies really
– Absolutely.
Or yesterday I was on the phone with Time Warner – of some cable problem, and they kept me on the line for an hour and then hung up on me after an hour.
So there's
it seems
a lot
to me
of
that that's
the
opposite
the
of interaction.
But what we're trying to do, so the discussion group that I have helped lead, which includes very senior regulators from around the world, as well as CEOs of major corporations and advocacy groups, is to come up with what I call the New Deal on data. And you can't do it everywhere all the time. But what you can do is you can start with regulated industries, the banks, the telcos, the hospitals, because they want to get into this data game too. They want to spy on us and sell the data and so forth. But they have a license to operate, so the regulators have a big hammer over top of them. And what the regulators want to do is hold them to a much higher standard. And that standard is individuals control data about themselves so that you're in charge of your data, not the company, not the government either. That's the other part of it, okay? Now, is that going to work? Well, yeah, it's going to work in the telcos. It's going to work in the healthcare areas. And that's a lot of what I do is help them transition to this new way where it's not them in charge, it's the customers. Is it going to do something to Facebook? Well, not immediately. the attitude seems to be that if you can get the banks, if you can get the hospitals, if you can get the telcos in line with citizens controlling the data about them, then you can go to places like Facebook and these other sorts of things and straighten them out.
Alex Pentland directs MIT's Human Dynamics Laboratory and the MIT Media Lab Entrepreneurship Program, also co-leads the World Economics Forum Big Data and Personal Data Initiatives. His book, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread, The Lessons from a New Science, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.